what did you turn your attention to after that? I have a number of things here that you worked on in this. Well, let me back up for a moment. You became assistant director in 1930. How did that appointment occur?
Well, I guess it just grew like Topsy. It just grew because I was the first one there, and John liked me. We got along fine, and I was a very good listener. That's probably why John liked me the most, because I could listen to his ideas and not get too impatient. Sometimes I did get impatient, but I didn't show it. But that was the team we had then. It was Grevy and Bounty.
I have a list here of some other projects, and I'm not sure of the order, but maybe we could just talk about them briefly. Were you involved in making acetylene?
Only as an assistant lab director. Dr. Matheson was the one who was primarily interested in making acetylene. And Larry Amos was interested in trying to get the data necessary to decide whether acetylene or ethylene would be the future thing. And it's interesting, too, that now, after all these years, it begins to look to me as if about the time the oil gets to be either very expensive or it peters out entirely, and then coal comes along and the same thing happens to it, or even before that happens, when you have to grow trees or use coke, then maybe the acetylene method is going to be the way to do it. And maybe the way to do it would be to use energy from the sun to make calcium carbide, ship calcium carbide anywhere in the world you need to, and use that then, use the acetylene to make all the basic chemicals. And this could well be something that would happen, sometime in the far distant future. But it's at least a practical method of substituting natural trees and the charcoal from natural trees or coal for petroleum. And this is going to have to happen someday.
You instituted a training program for people in the Dow Well service. It was a technical training program.
It was a technical training program.
Did you start that? There were courses given, and as I understand.
Yes, Larry Amos had a lot to do with the courses. I guess I just, as John's assistant, was there and knew about it and helped out, but I don't think that I originated the idea.
Okay.
But Dow Well was one of the things that the physics lab did early that turned out to be very, very important.
Were you involved at all in that, or is that?
I was involved in it, but primarily as assistant director. It's interesting, about the time I became assistant director, Dr. Veazey, who was working summers, and really Dr. Veazey had assumed, that's the way you got authority in the Dow Chemical Company, was to just assume it, but at that time. So he had sort of, as far as I'm concerned, he had assumed the responsibility for the director of being director of research. But he called me in one day and said, well, now that you're assistant, one thing you need to be very careful of is not to discourage other people to have patents, that you should not get patents yourself. You should encourage other people, even if you give them your idea. So this is what I started to do about the time I became assistant director. I grew to the point where I just said, well, look, let's try this or let's try that. And John had done that before, too. He didn't worry about patents. He got quite a few. I had 15 before this happened, and then after that I didn't get involved in patents, except where it was just clearly something that I was involved in and somebody else wanted my name on it or something like that.
Do you have a list of those patents anywhere?
I do, but not here, not in Midland either.
Maybe
the Dow Chemical Company would have a list. I must have it somewhere, but I...
Maybe somewhere, if you're back in Midland, if you think of it, if you could send me a list of patents and paper publications.
I had about 15 publications and 15 patents. That's about the way it was.
Okay. If you have that list available, why?
I'll see if I do. Okay.
Did you... When you became assistant director, then, did that mean that you were removed, being more and more removed from actual participation in the laboratory work?
Yes, it meant that, But at the same time, it was such a small laboratory that I still did laboratory work as long as I was an assistant until I was transferred into the starting program. Mm-hmm. I still did research work.
Okay.
Quite a bit.
With Larry Amos, use of ferric chloride is for treating water, municipal waters and sewage. Mm-hmm. Did you work on that with him?
Yes, I worked on that with him.
What was behind that?
Behind that was the primary reason for it was that chlorine is a hard material, a difficult material to store, and yet you want your chlorine cells to operate continuously and uniformly 24 hours a day. So if you don't have any other use for the chlorine, let's just make ferric chloride, because this, you just bubble the chlorine through a solution with iron shavings and you make ferric chloride. So then what do you do with ferric chloride? And this was one of the things. And the other thing that Sacer developed was a photographic etching, which didn't use very much, but it was a good use for it. But the municipal precipitant, coagulant, I guess is what I should say, was a big use for many years.
Was that used just in Midland, or was it used?
No, it was used in Detroit, I'm sure. And it was used in Toronto because Larry and I had both made a trip to Toronto way early in the development work to help them get set up to use ferric chloride. And they did use ferric chloride in Toronto at the municipal waste disposal plant.
Could you also tell me something about Sylvia Stassert? You'd mentioned something about her briefly before we started taping, but could you tell me something about when she joined the lab and some of her early work there?
She joined the lab, again, I think it was 1930, but it was plus or minus a year. Mm-hmm. And she joined the lab because her husband was hired, and he would not come unless she was offered a job. And so they found a place for her, and John was very happy to have her in the physics lab. And the physics lab also, this is a peculiar reason for hiring somebody, but the physics lab was outside the fence. It was right next to the main office, and we'd had no restroom facilities for females in the laboratory, so she and the secretaries went to the main office where they had facilities. So that was another reason that had to be taken, another thing that had to be taken care of.
Were you involved in, did you talk to her at all before she was hired, or?
I don't remember that I talked to her before. I think we just, John talked to me and we agreed we wanted her and we had her, and we had her. I don't remember either one of us having a formal interview with her. We must have had, but I don't remember it.
Now, you said she was the first.
She was the first female chemist in Dow Research anywhere, and certainly the first PhD. And in our lab, she was the scientist of the group.
I see.
And everybody went to her to try out their ideas and to get help.
And what kind of work was she? What kind of work did she do when she?
She did work. She took over my work on the physical properties of Dow Therm and the heat stability of Dow Therm. That probably was one of our first jobs. This using ferric chloride as a photographic etchant was another one. And then the purity of styrene monomer. She was very, very much responsible for the total work on the actual making pure styrene monomer. And how do you do it? And inhibitors that you can use for the distillation and for storage and all that sort of a thing. I'll show you. Oh, I have to take this off.
Okay, yes.
One of the really difficult problems with styrene, polystyrene, was the fact that it etched and got foggy on the surface. And she is the one who discovered that it was a remaining monomer and low volatile material in general. If you remove all of that down to 1%, then the material was commercially practical and a good polymer. And at least one of the stories is that DuPont
did a great deal of work, research work on this, and they gave it up because it just simply wouldn't last. Well, here is a sample that's 50 years old, and that is her work. She was responsible for that.
Did she make those for a number of people?
Oh, she made them for... You can see what she did. She used burned-out electric light bulbs, and she filled it with monomer.
Right.
And put in for anything. We made a lot of them with magnesium crystals because they were so beautiful. But anything anybody wanted to preserve, they put it in there like that. She made them in the hundreds for everybody in the lab and a lot of people in the company. And then we used it for giveaways, too.
Yeah. That's the first one I've seen that anybody's told me about. That's excellent. You may have one of the few that remain from that period.
I suspect this is one of the very few that remain. In fact, I don't have many papers, but a lot of junk like this I have collected.
That's fascinating. That's fascinating. Just as an aside, we received a sample of the first sulfur-free tire. It's a slice of one of the early sulfur-free tires that was made.
Yeah.
So somebody had put away for 50 years or how, I guess it was 1924 when that was done. So, well, that's certainly worth preserving.
Well, let's see. Stacer, she stayed with the polystyrene purity and polystyrene program. And that probably was her biggest single contribution, although she made many other contributions, including helping out everybody else. But she did quite a bit of work on Dowell. She did a lot of work on the early work on Dowell, different inhibitors to use and that sort of a thing. I don't remember what else. She after about 10 years, she retired to raise a family.
I see. But she did come back.
She came back to write the...
the book.
Write the book on be the editor. If she hadn't have done that, we never would have...
You want me to do that?
We never had that book published. If she had not been willing to come back and really be the editor...
That's interesting. I was just talking to Ray about that book this morning. And... He told me a little bit about how that originated. We're getting a little ahead here, but why don't we continue with the book at least now. He said that he had put out 5 pamphlets, technical bulletins on styrene, that Willard Dow was on the editorial board of ACS Monographs, and he took that to the editorial board, and that became the nucleus of the book. Now, how did you get involved? Did Willard Dow come to you about that?
Yeah, I talked to, I'll tell you what I remember about it. I was in Willard Dow's office. We talked at least once a month. I just reviewed everything that was going on. But Willard Dow said to me, in effect, words like this. We have given, during the war, we have given to all of our good competitors all the information we have on styrene, how to make it, how to purify it, everything. Even a great deal of information on making the polymer from it because of the rubber program. And he said, now let's just make this a real race, a real competitive race. Let's publish everything we know about it. Let's let everybody have it, and we'll see who wins. And I think it was one of the smart things he did because it didn't hurt Dow Chemical Company at all. The competition was good for them.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And now Ray Boyer probably, he had also talked with Willard Dow, but Willard was the one who gave us permission to publish it, and was the one who actually encouraged us. And Willard Dow loved competition. He just loved competition, any competition by anybody. He often had 2 pilot plants in 2 different laboratories making the same thing by a slightly different process, just to get the competition. So this was a natural thing for him to say.
And who was responsible for getting Sylvia back into to serve?
Ray Boyer.
Ray was the one who got her in.
Yeah. I agreed, but Ray Boyer is the one who was responsible.
Well, let's come back then to, since we're talking about the styrene book, let's come back to when the physics lab first started getting into styrene. When did you first start working on styrene?
The organic lab under Dr. E.C. Britton had done just a small amount of work on making styrene from pure ethyl alcohol, and anyhow, they made I can't think of the proper name for it, but anyhow, it's a reaction product of benzene and alcohol, so that you get an alcohol, and then you dehydrate that to make the styrene. And this is a classical organic method of making styrene monomer, and they had made a little bit that way, and they had got the same crazing that DuPont had got. Well, Bobby Dreisbach, who worked in the physics lab, he knew that Dow had benzene, because they were making phenol from benzene, and he knew that we were just building a large ethylene plant and we're going to have excess ethylene. So what Bobby did was to make sort of a crossword puzzle in which on one axis he put down all the things that might react with ethylene, and benzene was one of them, and then on the other side he had ethylene, so that then in each compartment he filled in what might happen and what would it be and would it be commercial. And one of the things he ended up with was ethyl benzene, and then that dehydrogenated to styrene. And so that's how styrene got started. Bobby made this what we call the crossword puzzle and decided that this was the way to do it, and that making ethyl benzene and dehydrating ethyl benzene was the cheapest way to make it. So he is the one in Dow who really got us started. And Stacer is the one who was a scientist and made it possible.
Then I guess it was, I want to try and keep the date straight, but it was in 1942 when you were asked to head the expansion of the styrene production.
In about 19, this is also plus or minus a year, but about 1939, Willard Dow could see the war coming, and he didn't like to actually, I shouldn't say delegated, because he did delegate responsibility, but he didn't like to have a lot of vice presidents, let's say it that way. So he picked three of us, and two of us, Dr. Hebbard and myself, were from the physics lab, and Dr. Kendall, who was at that time running the ethylene plant, and made us assistants to the president, not assistant presidents, but assistance to the president, and then he would delegate to us different responsibilities. And once he had delegated it to you, you were on your own, and you could just go do it. And you had accountable freedom again.
Well, what was the state of styrene production in 1942 within the company before this occurred?
Let's go back to 1937. 1937, Dow had built the first, what we called at that time, a commercial plant. And we were making the monomer, making a good grade pure monomer. And then we used what we call the can method for making the polymer. Mm-hmm. And this was just simply putting in a 10-gallon can and carefully controlling the temperature over a period of time. But Then all we did was to grind up the polystyrene and sell it to either Monsanto or Bakelite. And that continued until the war started. And I guess it was 1942 before the rubber program really was initiated. I think that's right.
What was your responsibility? What did Dow give you as your...
As an assistant to the president, I was told, it's your responsibility. Go do it. That was it. And we had at one time a plant in Gary, Indiana that finally was not needed and wasn't actually even started. But we had Gary, Indiana, we had Texas, we had California, Los Angeles, and Port Huron, across the river from Port Huron.
Sarnia.
And I had the responsibility for getting those all built and initial operation, not the operation after they started. But the training of the personnel, we had not only did we have all of these plants of our own, but we had also a group of people from Coppers and a group of people from Monsanto who came in for training in the only commercial plant that was being operated in the United States in Midland, Michigan. Oh, we were building another plant in Michigan, too, at that time. So we had these five different plants. And once a month, I made a trip around, a circuit around each one of them.
Mm. Did you select those sites, or were those sites already...
Those sites were selected primarily by Rubber Reserve Company in Washington, D.C.
Oh, okay. All right.
It was a well-run, very well-run government organization. They did I think still a magnificent job.
And then Dow was under contract to build the plants that they determined.
Yes.
Did you? Who was your contact in Washington?
John Livingston. John Livingston. And then Brad Dewey. Right after that, Bradley Dewey. Both of them at one time or another were presidents of Rubber Reserve. But Livingston is the one who really, he was from Monsanto. And he's the one who did the legwork. Mm-hmm. Bradley Dewey stayed primarily in Washington.
How did you set out when you were given this responsibility it was really quite an undertaking to get five different places operational, constructed and operational.
I don't know how I did it, to tell you the truth. But I had an awful lot of good help, just darn good help. It's amazing, and it would be a good study in psychology for somebody today. We had 60 people in training at one time in Midland. Part of these, most of them were Dow. By that time, the technical personnel was pretty well at the bottom of the barrel. We had our own magnesium problems, and most of these kids were just an average group of technical employees. But there were 60 of them all together. And to study them and what happened to them, and the responsibility they were given all at once, a lot of responsibility, and the fact that out of that 60 came at least two presidents of companies, two or three or four vice presidents of companies, a lot of lab directors. It's just unbelievable that 60 people could contribute so much after the war. And I think it was primarily that they were given an awful lot of, at a very early age, they were pointed in the right direction and given a lot of accountable freedom.
Did you establish an organizational framework, people that worked under you and doing this?
I had one assistant, Mitchell, J.E. Mitchell, who was responsible for the training of all of the personnel, and also along with the training, the writing of the manuals for operation of the plants. And he had a manual for the automatic controls, and another instrumentation, automatic controls, another manual for ethylene production, and another manual for ethylbenzene production, and another manual for styrene production. And this was a terrific load off my mind. And then, except for the Midland plant, it's a New England, a Boston company was given responsibility for the design and construction. I can't think of the name right now, but it's well known. They're still in existence, and this was a very, very good. And they were able to do a great deal of what would sound like a very difficult job, but they were able to do that. And we sent engineers from our own engineering department out to Boston. Stone and Webster, that's the name.
Yes.
But we sent them out there, and they were in-house and helped in the design. But then Stone and Webster did do the design and the construction. And we intentionally built the plant in, well, Texas is a good example. It was the largest plant. But we built it in four different units, each unit small enough that a manager could understand and see all the piping. And if anything went wrong, you only lost one-fourth of your plant rather than the whole plant. Today, I'm sure the logical thing to do would be to build one huge plant, one huge ethylene plant, so on and so forth, right down the line. But we didn't. We built four with their own inventories, each one a separate unit, so that if sabotage or fire or anything shut down one unit, you'd have a chance to keep the others running. And also because it was easier for an operator to understand that kind of a plant.
How did you select the personnel that were running these plants? Where did they come from?
They were the 60 people that we hired. Most of them were just new graduates out of school. Out of that 60 people we hired, only three had any production experience whatever. So you can see what a responsibility these kids were given all at once. They were just pointed in the right direction, but the plants were designed with the fact in mind that this is the kind of people who would be running the plants, and you shouldn't make them complicated.
Did these 60 all come in at the same time then?
They came in all in...
In the
same year.
Yeah.
Yes, and they were all in Midland at one time. And Mitchell, J. E. Mitchell, was responsible for the training and for the writing, as I mentioned.
Do you know if any of those manuals still exist? Do you know if any of those training manuals still exist? Would the company have any?
I'm sure they do, and that would be very interesting. And I don't know where to tell you to go to get them. I'll leave it up to me to start a plan. I know at least for a start.
Okay, that would be great, because they certainly would be...
It would be very good. I'd like to see them again,
yes.
Too.
To take people like that and to train them to run plants of that kind in really short order.
Yes.
Time was of the essence.
And those plants started up on schedule. They started up without a single last-time accident. It's just unbelievable.
How long was that? You started in 1942. When were they in production?
They were operating in less than 2 years.
Wow.
Operating at design capacity in less than 2 years. That alone today would be an impossible job. But at that time, it didn't seem to be. There's so much more red tape today. I don't know whether I could stand it or not. Government red tape, ecology red tape, everything.
Well, I think everything is much more complicated today than it was then.
It is.
Certainly that.
And while we didn't have any accidents, neither did we consider the safety like we do today. Mm-hmm. Here again, I think it was primarily if a youngster understands what is possible and what has to be done safely, he'll even operate a hazardous equipment in a safe way.
Mm-hmm.